Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Cult of Gracie on XXBN, a media project run by Swap East, a sex worker outreach project. Tonight our guest is Dr. Michael Goodyear from the Dalhousie University in Canada. And I know that some of you who listen to the show have probably read a great deal about Michael at my blog and other places talking about tonight's guest. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Medicine at Dalhousie University. And from there, he's sort of got a meandering path based on research and women's health issues into actually becoming a sex worker advocate for decriminalization. My first question, besides welcoming you to the show, Dr. Goodyear, is I'm kind of wondering how that path worked for you. How did you start out in medicine and in research and end up, you know, into the area of sex work?
Well, actually, it was the other way around, Gracie.
When I was
a medical student, in Australia back in the 1970s, my first, serious relationship was with the Australian feminist writer Beatrice Faust, and who was doing research on sex work at that time with the women's electoral lobby. And she shared a lot of her field notes with me, and I did a project on it and became interested in it. And I was working in the emergency department of an inner city hospital in Melbourne, in the state of Victoria, where, of course, obviously a lot of the people that came through the emergency department were sex workers with various problems. They call themselves exotic dancers, but you know. And the other part of that story is that because you deal with a lot of injuries and assaults and things in emergency departments, you end up in court a lot, having to give evidence. And while I'm sitting around in court on Fridays, there'd always be a lineup of sex workers, you know, basically being hauled in by the police, you know, and they'd be sort of fined and thrown out the other door, and then, you know, the next Friday they'd be back in the front door again, you know, and I began to appreciate the revolving door policy. So I got immersed in it very early on. And I was involved in a lot of other activities through the Women's Electoral Lobby. I got involved in the Family Planning Association of Australia and also the Abortion Law Reform Association of Australia. So a whole lot of interconnected women's health issues, of which sex work just happened to be one.
Now, my assumption was before that, you know, maybe you had some emergency room experience, and I would, based on what I've experienced and what I've heard so many of the doctors and professionals who get, especially repeat customers, as they would call them, coming in as from sex work, that, you know, they see one of the most negative sides of the industry and probably
Absolutely,
the most
yes.
vulnerable part of our population. And so a lot of them form negative images on all of sex work based on that population pool.
Well, the other place I've noticed where people form very negative images are in detox programs. So, you know, programs dealing with alcohol and other substance abuse. There obviously is a number of sex workers there. And people, again, make those sort of negative assumptions that you've just made. They start to extrapolate from a small group of people with particular problems to the entire profession, if you like, and that, of course, is not confined to people in healthcare. That's unfortunately confined to many people who write or talk or think about the whole issue. It's an issue that, have you noticed, that everybody seems to know everything about, and they all know the answers?
Yeah.
It's instant expert. Yes.
Well, and one of the things that myself and some of my, you know, I call them sisters who are in the movement of getting at least the myths corrected.
Brothers and sisters, yeah. Well, sisters and brothers. Sisters and brothers and others, I say.
Yes. Well, we, you know, one of the things we're stymied by is this, we do admit that there, especially when it comes down to what you would call the street worker element of this industry, that they are the most vulnerable. They do their solicitation in a public forum, you know, public viewing, and they're most at risk for violence, and they tend to be the more people most trapped by poverty and those issues of drugs and abuse and homelessness. And yet, if we complain when someone such as myself, who was an escort and not on the street, when I complain that that wasn't my experience, then I'm accused of denying the experiences of those workers. And so we kind of have a hard time. We want to acknowledge and work towards, you know, harm-free situations for those workers. But at the same time, it's not everyone involved in sex work.
Well, I mean, the battle that you have is what one would call philosophically essentialist arguments. That is to say, those who believe that they've identified the essence of sex work and that these are immutable characteristics of sex work and apply to it wherever it's practiced around the world or in any context or any culture or any geography. And, of course, that's absolute nonsense. I mean, there's, you know, there's galaxies of difference between what one might call very high-end courtesan, you know, people who, well, I can, some of my friends, you know, would consider themselves to be professional companions, you know. In other words, they basically are selling their time, and what happens afterwards between two consenting adults is none of your business. As you say, the relatively small segment of the sex work industry that's mainly on the street or in the public forum, which is around about 10 to 20%, depending on how you define it. But even within that 10 to 20%, there's an enormous variety of different lifestyles and different reasons for being there, from people who are actually keeping one foot in each camp. In other words, they do some indoor work and they do some outdoor work for various reasons, to people who just prefer to be on the street, to people basically who are on the street for the reason that many people are on the street, because they're homeless, because they're incredibly poor, because they have substance abuse, because they've run away from home, because they're being, you know, they're victims of violence. And, you know, and amongst those are the ones that are often called people who are there for survival sex. In other words, when all else fails, they turn to selling sex to basically stay alive. Now, what is the connection between any of those people other than the fact that they, from time to time, exchange sexual services for goods or money? The answer is really not much. Those people all have far more in common with other people around them of the same class, background, education, residential neighborhood, and many other factors than they do with each other. And that actually, that's sort of a good thing and a bad thing. I mean, it's a good thing in terms of, well, you know, there could be some solidarity there, but it's sort of a bad thing because, in fact, they have very little in common with each other, and you often don't get that solidarity between the different ends. In fact, I sometimes regretfully see sort of infighting between groups who predominantly represent street group, you know, working people, and people who predominantly represent, say, escorts, who really don't see that they have anything in common at all and don't want to be associated with each other. You know, which is understandable, but doesn't sort of help it when, you know, they're being assailed from all sides by people who want to all lump them together and consider that, you know, to quote the usual phrase, you know, that sex work is violence against women and you're letting down the side in terms of equality. So, you know, I think you've put your finger on the essential point, returning to that word, is the fact that there's an enormous diversity, and that if you're not careful, everyone wants to lump it together and think that you know, the same solutions or the same issues arise in every single part of the industry.
Okay, I'm going to just mention again that this is Cult of Gracie Radio on XXBN. This is Gracie Bissett. I'm broadcasting from Fargo, North Dakota, while the XXBN network is a part of Swap East and therefore belongs to, legally, Raleigh, North Carolina. If anyone is listening and has a question for Dr. Goodyear, please give us a call at 646-231-36. There's a couple of things you said in there that really struck me. One is statistics, because this is something that I find very, very few reliable information studies and resources to look to from an advocacy point of view or not, simply because any research can have difficulty. You'd know that more than I.
Absolutely, yes.
But when they...
And particularly in this area. Yeah.
Right, because people don't necessarily find themselves by their work because of the legal status or the illegal status of the work. They aren't going to come forward and name themselves.
No, so
you're going to get a really small segment of people who are going to be willing to participate.
Yeah, you can't go out and get a representative sample or a random sample the way you would do with a telephone survey across the country if you want to find out, detergent people buy, or whether they're going to vote Democrat or Republican. As you say, people are hard to identify, and so a lot of the research tends to be done for convenience reasons on accessible populations. Street workers are often more accessible than indoor workers who are hidden away from the visible eye, and even worse than that, it's street workers who are in trouble in the courts or in hospital or in detoxification programs and other things like that tend to be the groups that people want to study because they're there, and then unfortunately either they or worse, maybe other people who read their work, then extrapolate or generalize the findings from that tiny group to the entire profession, which of course is absolute nonsense. So yes, you will find the majority of the research tends to be on street workers, and what work there is that compares various issues that street workers have with people who work indoors, they have entirely different outlooks on life, experiences of life, and needs. For instance, they use healthcare services quite differently.
Yeah, well, when you mentioned earlier that depending on the study, it's 10 to 20% are considered a street worker category, what study or where do you get those numbers from that you feel that they're fair enough to use?
They're actually very consistent around the world. Here in Canada, one could look at the work of John Lerman in Vancouver. You could look at some of the work in San Francisco. Australian figures, New Zealand figures are much the same. I mean, as good as you can actually get, you know. It's a small visible number of people. Well, would that actually create the problem? And when I say problem, I mean problem from a political point of view. I'm not saying that they are a problem, although people want to make them a problem. Because, I mean, what actually happens in terms of policy and policing and law enforcement is that residents basically see street workers or hear them at night or think even people are street workers when they're not. They get on the phone, they call the police, they call the local city council, they call their politicians, they demand something, quotes unquote, be done. And so the police are told that they have to crack down and then, and pass tougher laws and the cycle sort of continues. And you and I know that laws against prostitution and sex work have never been shown to actually be effective at all. In any country in the world, take one example. Take China. After the Second World War, when the communist government of Mao Zedong took over, one of their programs was the eradication of sex work. As being inconsistent with the communist economy. Well, they passed the most draconian laws in the world against prostitution. And how many people are there working in sex work in China at the moment? Well, about 10 million. Yeah. it's one of what's called symbolic laws. In other words, it makes people feel good that they've done something and they've passed a law, but it does absolutely nothing whatsoever in terms of changing it. I mean, it can change the way it appears. I mean, when in England in 1959 they passed very strict laws about solicitation, yes, overnight women melted away from the street and they all popped up in cafes and bars and little cards in shop windows and things, the next day, and then you can have big police drives in one city or one neighborhood or one suburb, and yes, it has an effect, and what happens? They all pop up in the next city or the next street over or the next suburb, In other words, it displaces rather than really alters it. And that's been pretty consistent over the years and in every single country that it's been studied, that legislation does absolutely nothing to achieve its stated objectives, and that's bad law.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. I mean, sometimes I feel like on the show we preach to the choir, but my hope is that there'll be someone listening here that doesn't get it.
And I understand.
One of the things
people keep doing it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that surprised me, maybe it shouldn't have, was a while ago there was a ABC here in the United States, a 2020 program with Diane Sawyer that said they were going to go undercover and talk to real sex workers, and so there was lots of horrific things in that so-called report. But the number she kept spewing was this 80% number, which is like, if you're talking street workers are 10 to 20%, which is a tip of an iceberg,
yeah.
And the most visible part is what people want to legislate. She had the numbers reversed. I mean, 80%
yes.
of us are drug users, 80% of us are on the streets. And I'm wondering where she even got that sort of number. And this leads me back to one of the most rampant foaming at the mouth people of our day, which is, you know, Melissa Farley and her crew. Who, you know, I want to believe in my little black heart that this is out of some caring motivation. It's sort of like, you know, being in the emergency room or in the social work office and someone comes in and you want to help, but you really don't understand the issue, so you're kind of making things worse, you know?
Yeah, well, there are a lot of very interesting issues there. I mean, I think people quite rightly are suspicious and skeptical about statistics, and the reason for that is you need to know how the statistics were gathered, you know, and what was done with them. I mean, you can find numbers anywhere. The next part of that is that you can pick up any newspaper article, and I just got one sitting in front of me here. Actually, I sent an email to you a little earlier in the day from the Islington Gazette, which is in London, England, you know, where we see figures of, you know, hundreds of thousands of people being trafficked, you know, into Germany for the World Football Club, you know. I mean, you know, there's absolutely no basis for that whatsoever. It's been investigated to death, and absolutely nothing was found, and yet Here's a member of parliament repeating it yet again, you know, in a newspaper interview, you know, today, you know, and you would expect that politicians, you know, members of parliament to have some bit more responsibility to check their facts. So figures just go round and round the world, and they probably sort of, somebody adds another zero every time that goes past them. Also, interviews with people who we might call prohibitionists, you know, the really rabid anti-trafficking people who want to lump all prostitution into trafficking. I mean, they've actually, some of them even admitted that, well, yes, there's probably no basis for that number, but it doesn't matter. It's such a serious crime that, you know, in other words, they so believe in what they're doing that they'll make up anything to make sure that their cause, you know, becomes triumphant and wins. And that's pretty scary stuff. The other thing I picked up on there, and I agree with it, isn't just your little caring heart. I mean, if we look at the great divides in feminisms, you know, the debates on pornography and prostitution, the one thing you will find if you try to find some rapprochement, some, you know, area of consensus between the two poles, you know, and the argument about, you know, sex work is work and sex work is violence against women, is that they all actually do care about the women in the sex work industry, and they don't want to see them being penalized or, you know, or criminalized or, you know, punished, you know, but they have different ways of going about it. Now, frankly, I think that the prohibitionist lobby actually end up hurting, you know, the women that they're supposed to be rescuing or caring about, because their zeal for being seen as the, you know, the great rescuers, you know, just exceeds their better judgment. You know, you'll notice that I'm very carefully using the word prohibitionist there, because prohibition is something, at least in the United States, that everybody understands, because they saw what happens when you pass laws to prohibit the use of alcohol, and how not only was it totally useless, but it actually generated a whole lot of social problems and crime and cost the country millions of dollars in law enforcement, and you know, ended up creating a far worse mess than they had before they started. Whereas the people that you and I are talking about here like to call themselves abolitionists, which is a very confusing term, because what is it you're trying to abolish? But it very neatly, of course, slides itself into the image of, you know, rescuing sort of slaves, you know, and of course we just recognize the anniversary or bicentenary of William Wilberforce, you know, who led the campaign to free slaves, you know, in, from Great Britain. So, you know, that image of the rescuer is a bit of a Victorian melodrama, and, you know, which the hero, you've got the hero and the victim and the rescuer coming to rescue people who actually may not want to be rescued. But it makes great drama, and it makes great stories in newspapers.
Well, I think that it's rather like in certain things in my country right now regarding a certain war,
yes.
Fear mongering and people. But I think that if they listen to actual facts about sex work and even street prostitution, if they were to break down and separate street prostitution from a drug issue, from a homelessness point of view, and that people who aren't able to function aren't able to make good decisions, but that doesn't mean that the whole industry needs to go out with the bathwater. And that helping someone break free of drugs, in my mind, does not mean that they need to end their sex work either. I mean, they're two separate issues that may be related in one person.
Sensationalism sells newspapers, Gracie, and it's also great on the political hustings when you're trying to get votes. You know, you identify a problem that you're going to fix, and then you pass laws to fix them, you know, when you're an attorney general or somebody like that. People don't want to hear the good news. They only want to hear the bad news, and that's how it goes. Now, you talked a little earlier about, you know, the creating sort of fear and, you know, what sociologists would call a moral panic. And, you know, that goes back a long way, probably at least until the early 19th century when, you know, it was decided, you know, for instance, in England, although it was reenacted in America and many other countries, that the moral fiber of the country was being eroded by venereal disease and that the country would no longer be able to fight any wars because the soldiers all had VD. And, of course, naturally, they were being given this VD by these nasty, evil women. So all you have to do is to round up all the women and put them in prison and the country would be free of disease. Now, you know, that's a strange understanding of the way infectious disease works, isn't it? But the concept of that, of women as the vectors of disease, you know, that who should be punished for this, you know, has persisted. And then in the late 19th century, with the rise of the social purity movement, came this myth of the white slave trade. Which, and when I say myth, because it was shown that William Steed, who wrote this story about this, a journalist, you know, in fact made the whole thing up, but it was highly effective, you know, the idea that innocent young white girls were being, you know, whisked away by nasty foreigners and sold in markets in the Middle East, you know, to, you know, become parts of harems or, you know, sheiks, you know, sort of entourage. And that, you know, has gradually sort of morphed into this whole trafficking emotionalism that's, you know, that the State Department in the US is spending, well, I don't know what figure they're spending, but it's certainly an obscene amount, apart from funding certain people that we mentioned earlier, to do research and to create disasters like they just did in Cambodia, where they rounded up all the sex workers and threw them into prison and beat them up and a number of them died. Basically to get the approval of the U.S. State Department that it's doing something about this nasty evil of trafficking, which, you know, is just a made-up word, you know, that to account for the fact that sex workers, like other people, migrate to areas where they have better economic opportunities. I'm not saying that trafficking, that is to say true trafficking, that is to say people who have been basically bound and gagged and dragged across borders, and it doesn't exist. Of course it exists, but not only in sex work, in many other sorts of work, you know, and sweatshops for, you know, labor. It does exist, but only to a very small amount, and the fact that in every country in the world, law enforcement agencies have been putting an enormous amount of resources into finding and rescuing these women and children. You notice they always had children on the end, because that's, you know, carries much more votes. But they never seem to be able to find them. And so the answer is, oh, we need to put more and more resources into it. Does that sound to you like the search for the weapons of mass destruction?
No. What amazes me is I think that most people that read the newspapers, and maybe I'm, again, being kind-hearted here, but I think they would prefer to have the actual information.
Yes. But, you know, journalists, you know, to be fair, work under pressure. They have deadlines, you know, and as I said, they have editors who want, you know, headlines and things. And, you know, it's just so easy to repeat what you, you know, saw in some other newspaper than to actually sit down and do some proper investigative journalism. And, you know, there are obvious exceptions to this, one being a recent article in the Washington Post by Markham, you know, which basically, you know, suggested that the whole thing was a myth, you know, and that... you know, we were pouring, you know, vast amounts of resources into chasing something that wasn't there. And, you know, predictably people screamed and yelled and said, you know, this is a terrible crime, you know, you can't trivialize it. Well, you know, unfortunately, the problem is that when you create sensationalism, what you do is you actually divert people's attention away from the real problem. So, you know, there are real people out there who need to be helped, and we're so busy trying to find the bogey, you know, that we actually miss it. Huh? So... trivializing, you know, I mean, making all sex work, you know, violence against women, as Elizabeth Wood has said, you know, trivializes the violence against women, you know. By lumping it all together with other things, you miss the real problem. And coming back to what you were saying is that, you know, that about some of the problems that some sex workers have. I mean, yeah, sex workers often attract violent people because they are seen to be somebody, you know, that's disposable. So therefore we should abolish sex work, goes the political argument. I mean, women unfortunately get battered and abused in marriage, so we should abolish marriage. And so, you know, I think you can see how the argument can go on and on. What's often missing in any discussions about sex work is positioning it in society in general and saying, well, what is different? You know, the article I sort of emailed to you earlier today says that 85% of prostitutes in this country come from abroad. Well, I think you would find that 85% of people who work in restaurants in London come from abroad, but, you know, because, you know, people come to London to work. No, but what it, you know, but you can see the connotation is totally different when you isolate one little component from the big picture.
Well, and that's been largely my frustration with these myths, is we talk about sex work as an industry without comparing it to other industries.
Absolutely.
You know, it's unto itself. It is without, it doesn't have any comparison to you know, it's like you said, any other service industry. And I'm not just talking about our rights to healthcare, but I mean, when we do the whole conversation, we aren't able to say, you know, talking about apples, compare them to other apples or even to oranges. We talk about sex work as an industry, as this independent thing that somehow all other comparisons and frameworks and intelligence just goes out the window. And it's frustrating.
Well, I mean, you know, there are two things that fascinate people in this world, and one is sex and one is money, and you put the two together and you've got the perfect combination. But, you know, I was just reading an article the other day by Audrey Macklin, who's an immigration lawyer at the University of Toronto. And she was pointing out that there are basically three groups of women who are abused and exploited, you know, at least in Canada, by being brought into this country. One is sex workers, particularly exotic dancers, so-called, anyway. One is domestic labor, and one is mail order brides. They're all basically brought into the country to do jobs that nobody else wants to do, and are basically exploited because they're migrants. You know, they're vulnerable because they can always be deported if they don't do as they're told, and they can't report abuse to authorities because, you know, they're possibly there for illegal purposes. And, you know, when you start to position it and you look at all of the other areas of exploitation, you begin to realize that there's nothing particularly unique about sex work. And I mean, but you know, reams and reams of paper have been written about this in feminist literature about, you know, is it like any other work or isn't it, and trying to sort of, you know, justify it one way or the other. I don't find any of those arguments particularly helpful. Annette Jolin, who's a criminologist in Portland, Oregon, basically, you know, has written an article about saying a debate that's held on the backs of workers, you know, because as you and I discussed elsewhere, you know, the one thing that's often missing in this debate is the people who are actually in the middle of it, you know, and they're never consulted. And when it comes down to the basic argument, they're the only people whose views actually matter. And yet somehow they seem to have no voice.
Well, I have to interrupt you here and mention again that this is Cult of Gracie on XXBN, and it appears that from my magical control panel that Blog Talk Radio had a server go down, and we aren't certain if this is all being recorded, or I'm guessing it was not streaming live, but we're hoping that it's been recorded. We are unsure. Now that the panel is back up and showing the right things, it looks right, but
we can always do it again, can't we?
Yes. Well, but I just, if anyone is listening now and wonders why they had silence, then they will know.
I will check with one of my fans. That's right.
I think the reason that, as a sex worker and knowing sex workers, I think the reason why some of these distinctions matter to us is because if you're going to treat us as some, you know, we're not an independent country, or we're not a part of your country, then we aren't really being, you know, there's no equality. Like you said, it's not just that we're missing from the conversation, but we're talked about like some object. And while most of these people would say that sex work itself is objectifying women, because that's the largest part of the workforce, that they really seem to believe that if they can talk about us without us being included, and you know, like we can't even understand the conversation around us. You know, that's really frustrating.
Just to interrupt you for a minute, Gracie, I'm getting an IM here from a listener who says it did go out and come back in a couple of times, and it just went out again, but only for a moment. So it is an interrupted service that we're providing. But whether it's being recorded or not, I can't say.
Oh, that's a problem. Everything looks fine here right now.
Yeah.
But according to Blog Talk Radio's official status is that their entire switchboard site went down and they were getting it back up. That it's up now is their official status. I don't know.
I apologize
to you and the listeners here, but it's when you're using an independent service like this, I can only see when it goes, you know, white or black, and I don't have any way to access what's going on, so I just have to trust their word, and their word is that it's back up. So
okay, we'll just carry on.
Yeah, we'll have to have you come back anyway, because there's a whole lot of information here, and I think that
it's a huge area. It's a huge area. It's a fascinating area, and it brings just so many different disciplines together. I mean, because you might ask why that is, and I think it's because it's not just the subject itself, I think, that's of great interest. I think it's the fact that it tells us a lot about the way society views sex and sexuality. And it's the way, and it reciprocates in the sense that the way we think about sex tends to make us think about the way we think about sex work, and tends to shape the way public policy tends to be directed towards or against sex work. I mean, I like the title of an article by Joe Dodzima, you know, basically talks about the control of lost women, you know, or lost women or loose women, she says. No? And there's actually a course taught at the University of California at Berkeley, actually, on prostitution, and it's what it's called, the control of loose women. So if you think of society's fear of female independence, you know, which basically only started to appear, you know, at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, then you can sort of understand why it appears that governments and, you know, and, well, I hate to use that word society because it means so many different things to different people, but, you know, social attitudes towards sex work tend to be so repressive and so fear-driven, you know.
Yeah.
You can, you know, even suggest that it goes back to the idea of the, you know, the preserving the purity of the gene pool, you know, that we can't let sort of women wander around and have multiple partners because, you know, they would be having they could be having multiple children from multiple partners.
Which as a species would actually be a good thing. But what strikes me about that is two things. Is one that I do agree fundamentally that the rights of sex workers are very much so a feminist issue, because how we're going to control this mainly female population seems very much like the Nazi thing with, you know, people go, well, I'm not going to, you know, they come for the sex worker, but I'm not going to worry about that because I'm not a sex worker and I don't use those services. But then the next step is who and what, you know, because it's controlling a group of women. And my other point is that I have a line I use all the time on the show, and so I will apologize to frequent listeners, but everybody poos, everybody screws, get used to it.
Yeah.
We have so many hang-ups about this, and one of the big ones seems to be this moral thing of sexuality somehow being more sacred than a biological function or motivation. But we don't scream, you know, when the landlord charges me my rent, I don't scream how immoral it is of him to charge me for shelter, which is a basic human need. I don't scream at the grocer when he charges me for food, which is a basic human need.
Yeah.
When someone charges for sex, which is a basic human need,
yes,
then suddenly it's this whole different ball game. And I'm just wondering from your education experience, where some of those lines might. Well,
you know, I mean, obviously we've been mainly talking about women here, but I mean, we must keep in mind, you know, the fact that there is all sorts of combinations in commercial sex. You know, there are men who sell sex to men, men who sell sex to women, women who sell sex to women, women who sell sex to men, and people who sell sex to, you know, to everybody at once.
Well, and then there's transgendered and
oh yeah, that's what I mean. and groups, and you know, and after all, you know, we're only talking about one area of sex work in a way, in terms of prostitution. We're not really talking about some of the, you know, the broader categories of erotic labor. Well, you know, there's a quotation I always remember from Margot St. James, who says, "We're the only ones who have the absolute right to fuck as many men as men fuck women." So, you know, this comes back to the gendering of this. You know, is it because, you know, if men were doing this to the same extent as women, you know, would there be the same social reaction? And that actually raises an even broader question about why aren't there as many women selling sex, sorry, men selling sex to women as there are women selling sex to men.
I was struck by that most of all in phone sex work. Because as a woman, listening to other women complain, the number one thing they want is their man to talk with them. So I would have thought male phone sex operators would be like the biggest cash cow ever.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? A man that calls up and does nothing but talk to you, and women being such huge auditory processing eroticism beings,
yeah,
that you know, a man could literally read to you from the phone book, and you'd be like all doughy-eyed and, you know, flustered. And yet that doesn't seem to be the case, and so there are some distinctions in our wiring or our biology that do make that sort of need for sex not quite as direct as a man's, I think.
Well, I mean, obviously women's expression of sexuality has changed drastically over the last 100 years or so. I mean, it doesn't mean to say that the need hasn't been there, but, you know, it's been repressed for so long, and, you know, as you have commented on a number of other programs and interviews you've done, you know, I mean, that it's now far more out in the open, whether it be Sex in the City or, you know, other things, or, you know, sex shops, you know. I mean, it's got a long way to go, but, you know, maybe in a truly egalitarian society, you would find an equal amount of commercial trade in both directions. You know, it has been argued that in a truly equal society, prostitution would disappear, and therefore you have to get rid of prostitution to obtain equality. Although I'm actually looking at a manifesto here in front of me that says, adult sex work should be fully decriminalized to advance women's equality and protect their safety, you know, which is the exact opposite argument. Maybe under a different social structuring, you know, that you would find more women, you know, wanting to sort of buy sex from men.
And I don't think women wouldn't want to, but I think the direct connection between impulse and satisfaction for men is a much shorter direct route. So what women might be purchasing would not, you know, it would be erotic to them, but it would not look, you know, it would not look the same way as prostitution, for example, looks now, where it's man has, you know, urge, man goes, pays cash, gets sex act. Whereas for women, I think it would be a little more, you know, meandering, you know. It wouldn't necessarily be so direct. I think it's just the way that we're wired. But I, you know, and that's one of these things I'm looking for now, to look at, well, where are we buying that then? Because we must be getting it somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be more in the sexual tourism area, at least in terms of the literature that has researched that. You know, there was the film Going South about women, professional middle-class American women going to the Caribbean and buying sex there. Recent survey of Australian women, when asked if they'd ever bought sex, said only when overseas, you know. So there is that sort of idea that when you're outside of your own society that you behave differently. But, I mean, you know, I've stressed right from the start that we have to be very careful about generalizations, because people get into sex work for many different reasons, stay in sex work for very different reasons, and get different things out of it. But some research has actually found women sex workers saying that actually they're in sex work because they are, to some extent, purchasing sex, but they actually get paid for it. They actually get the sex that they're looking for. I mean, you know, that again, I'm just saying that's not, you know, necessarily a general thing, but it's certainly one particular motivation or area of satisfaction that some female sex workers have mentioned.
Well, that's the thing that brings me back again to sex work as an industry, because we don't really worry about all the varied facets of reasons why somebody wants to be an IT professional or a doctor or a radio host. We don't put such a magnifier on that. And yet, for every one of those industries I just mentioned and all the other ones, we have drug use, homelessness, domestic violence, rape. We have those things running through all those sectors. And while we waste our time kind of looking on some of these issues about what makes a sex worker tick, we're missing the real issues of how to separate, the real problem. The problem is drugs. The problem is homelessness.
It's unpacking all those issues and dealing with them separately instead of lumping them together. But you're quite right. We've talked about the flaws in research earlier on, and one of the flaws in research is an undue amount of attention as to why women go into sex work, which isn't really the most important issue. And you could actually ask, and it has been pointed out, that actually a much more interesting issue would be why they didn't go into sex work. What is it that that makes people with the same social backgrounds resist it? Far more interesting would be how women cope with sex work, how they deal with the issues that come up, the strategies that they develop in terms of, organizing their lives and dealing with it, and, the various mechanisms they have for ensuring their personal safety. But, research gets driven by what's popular, about where people can get research funds, and by particular ideologies that happen to be dominant. Which brings me to one of the most important things in research, when you're dealing with research with communities and populations, is that from an ethical point of view, and I saw some blurb about that you put out earlier today, research on a population should really only be something that arises from that population. In other words, sex workers should be the people who are saying what they think the important areas of research on sex work should be, and they should be prominent in devising that research, participating in it, and directing it. If you're not doing research that benefits sex workers, you shouldn't be doing it. And that's what I found particularly terrifying about that study that Melissa Farley was involved in interviewing men who buy sex in Scotland. It was done without any oversight whatsoever, and basically they were out to get those men, They weren't doing anything to benefit those men. In fact, they were harming them, and you can't harm the people you do research on. That's not, that's just not acceptable. The most successful, research in sex work is what's known as participatory, research, where basically, you sit down with sex workers and decide what they think's important, and, you can have a questionnaire, you decide what questions they think, they need to know the answers to.
That's a very good point. Are there any places that are working in collaboration with?
Yeah, New Zealand would be. Look, I may be biased because I am a New Zealander, but frankly, it is the model, at the moment in the world for how to go about this. Essentially, you've got sort of three groups of people working together on this in New Zealand. You've got the academics, the researchers, and the universities. You've got the government, the Ministry of Health, the Ministry of Justice, and you've got the sex workers. And the government decided to fully fund the New Zealand Collective of Prostitutes, which is the union, if you like, as a partner with the Ministry of Health to be the agency that provides social and health services to sex workers. And those three branches of society, if you like, basically, I know all of them, work extremely well together. They're all good friends, socially and professionally, and they work collaboratively and they produce useful data, like the report that just came out last month that, evaluated the first 5 years since New Zealand got rid of all the laws on prostitution. And guess what? The sky didn't fall, Chicken Little.
Yeah, amazing.
In fact, actually,
so
good things happened.
So that would mean that if I'm a sex worker and at any level and I get raped or I get, harmed, I can walk in and get medical services and legal services without fear of prosecution. It's an amazing thing.
Yeah, I was in Christchurch in New Zealand, which has quite a high population of sex workers, last year, and a sex worker was threatened by a client. She pressed the 911 button on her cell phone, and within seconds, the whole block was cordoned off. There were police cars everywhere, and she was rescued.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that what 911 or emergency services are supposed to be for? She's not supposed to, you know, waste time making herself more vulnerable, deciding whether or not she should push that button because would the benefits outweigh the risks?
I mean, very few people have actually done some research on asking how much does this actually cost society. And the amounts that are spent in the United States on law enforcement against sex work are astronomical. And you quoted in your blurb an article I had written last year, you know, in which I'd say that, you know, that if policing was diverted from prosecution to protection, you know, it would not only cost a lot less, but, you know, but the results would be much more favorable in terms of, you know, law and order on our streets and violence and various other social benefits. So, you know, there's a very strong economic argument, and I say that because economics does seem to be one argument that politicians and law enforcement people seem to actually listen to.
And voters, too.
That's the thing,
we have to reach the everyday kind of person to be able to look at facts and make a decision, because they're the ones that are going to vote to keep, you know, Yahoo number one in office or not, and, you know, if they're going to go along with that bit of legislation. So, you know, that's why I get concerned sometimes that, not sometimes, all the time, when I read these media pieces that are just so full of myths and too lazy to check out actual facts, that they just keep perpetuating these myths. And the average person goes, well, you know, I read it in such and such. I heard it over here. It's got to be true because it's been repeated everywhere. It's not really, you know, Wikipedia mentality as far as facts, I guess. But
unfortunately, but so, yes. The Wikipedia articles aren't particularly good. I've tried to, you know, correct them a few times, but I said that it's not a good source of information on this particular subject, certainly. I'll give you another example of this. I mean, earlier this year, I decided to sit down and sort of go through the books and look at all of the pieces of legislation, all of the sort of official government reports and inquiries and commissions and, you know, committees that had been appointed in the United Kingdom to investigate sex work for the last, you know, since the 18th century. And there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. And at the end of it, you know, the situation isn't much different to when it started, you know.
Yeah.
And how much all of that cost, you know, I would hate to think. And, you know, and all for nothing.
Well, and that's, you know, that's where, like, you know, that spinning the wheels mentality that I see so much is, you know, maybe if sex workers were involved in the research, we would actually get to something instead of this rhetoric, which only causes more harm with keeping, you know, it a criminal activity. And the social stigmas, I'd like to get into that in a few minutes, but I have to once again say it is called Gracie Radio on XXBN, part of the Swap East Media Project operating out of Raleigh, North Carolina. If you have any questions for the doctor, you can call in at 646-200-3136. We have about 12 minutes left on the show. We can continue to record, as I mentioned to you before, if you'd like to stay a little late because we had the glitches. Anyone who's listening, the show will stop streaming at an hour in about 12 minutes. The doctor and I will probably keep up for a few more minutes yet because I've got a couple extra questions here. You want to continue to listen, also dial 646-200-3136. You will hear the entire show live on your telephone then. One of the things I wanted to mention to you is I was surprised and delighted to find an academic speaking out on this, because there seems to be more and more lately academics who describe themselves as feminists who are coming out on the abolitionist or prohibition side. It's like saying pro-choice or, you know, all that terminology. But they're being quite vocal in the name of feminism to end, you know, sex work. And it seems like there's very few academics who are, you know, they may be immersed in the debate in the ivory tower, but they're not out on websites challenging media and trying to hold them accountable. And so I was really impressed with that.
A number of interesting observations there. Well, first, it's very difficult to actually count this. I remember, you know, asking a prominent American sociologist last year about, you know, how many American academics were actually doing, you know, interesting and useful work on sex work. You know, and, you know, his reply was, well, you know, not many, because, you know, it's not considered to be a socially acceptable thing to do research on. As one of my colleagues put it recently, she could write a thesis on the reactions to people had when she told them what she was doing her thesis on.
Right.
And the second thing is that if they are you know, the other point he made is exactly the same as you made, that if they're doing something, they're up in the ivory tower, and therefore they're largely ignored. So, you know, why I think that what you and I are doing to some extent is so important is that we're not in the ivory tower, because people don't read the eminent and scientific journals, you know, in which this work is published. You know, it doesn't appear in the New York Times. You know, it doesn't get quoted in Congress, whereas the other stuff does. You know, certain people that we've mentioned earlier in this program who do research that is not authorized and overseen by somebody and is published in reports and self-published books, you know, that's what gets all the publicity. I mean, a very good example is, you know, is what's been going on in Nevada. You know, Nevada is the, for those who are listening outside the United States, is the one area of the United States where prostitution is not illegal, although that's only in certain counties. And therefore is of great interest to both sides, because clearly there are some people who want to shut down this remaining loophole in the United States and some people who want to see that become the model for the rest of the country. So you have Melissa Farley, I don't know how much time she spent there, sort of, you know, parachuting herself into Nevada and writing a book about how terrible and ghastly it is. And you've got people like Barb Rentz and Kate Hausberg at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, who spent most of their professional career studying, you know, brothels in Nevada, whose research shows precisely the opposite. So, you know, who do you believe, you know? So, and who gets the publicity? Well, Bob Herbert writes an article in the New York Times that gets syndicated all around the world, you know, saying, you know, that we should shut down, you know, all of the sex work in Nevada because, you know, people are being brutalized there and it's, you know. And what is the general public to believe? And also, what is the general public actually likely to hear? I think there's a lot more feminist scholars writing pro-sex work than maybe you know about. There are not many in the United States, but, you know, I've just mentioned a few. But there's a hell of a lot in the United Kingdom. In fact, probably the bulk of sex work research that's being done at the moment is being done in the United Kingdom and to some extent in Australia and New Zealand. I'm just looking at a book that's just been published, for instance, by Teela Sanders at the University of Leeds called Paying for Pleasure, Men Who Buy Sex. And I should say that the paying for pleasure is in very large type and men who buy sex in very small type, because she started off studying men who buy sex, but then wrote a book about, you know, about pleasure and the way society sees pleasure and why some people don't think you should be allowed to have any pleasure, you know? You know what the 11th commandment is? Thou shalt not be happy, you know?
And then, like, with the species ends because we're not having sex.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it's just the idea that people are actually might be out there actually, you know, enjoying themselves and getting pleasure, and whether they pay for it or not. And as Teela sort of points out, you know, you've really got to look at this in the big picture in terms of, you know, how people derive pleasure, you know, how relationships work. One of our colleagues in the West Coast, Norman Jean, put it rather bluntly to me. She said, if you come and mow my lawn for me, and she said, we end up in bed together, we could both go to jail, you know?
Yeah.
Because there's been an exchange of services, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, and if I take you out to dinner and, you know, and I offer to pay for the meal and, you know, and we eventually, you know, end up in bed, well, you know, is that prostitution? No, I mean, all relationships have some degree of economics and some degree of, you know, commerce and some degree of exchange, you know. You know, honey, wash the dishes tonight and I'll be nice to you, you know. And yet, you know, why do we sort of, you know, make such a song and dance about, you know, what's more strictly sort of commercial, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, everybody poos, everybody screws. There are people
who get enemas,
and no one, I mean, people may make jokes about that profession a little bit, because it's a bodily function, and we're an immature society who laughs at the word booger. But,
well,
you know, it's a biological need. You need to get it done. Feel bad for you, but glad you have a place to go and get it done. You know, sex work should be kind of the same way. One of the things that I've kind of found interesting from a historical point of view is the interconnection between sexuality and morality as it was legislated and sort of adopted or passed through faith to get the population to believe and adhere to it. And that a lot of these things come down to situational, you know, country or culture specific needs for population control, whether they need more children or less children to make their their civilization, you know, function properly. And I'm sort of wondering right now what this whole, these debates about here are really trying to legislate. If it's not just control your loose women,
you're opening a whole can of worms there about the intersection of law and morality. And when you think about all the things that we have tried to criminalize, you know, over the centuries in different countries in the world, you know, I mean, you know, it seems laughable today. I mean, you know, it's articles often sort of appear in blogs and things about weird laws, particularly state laws in the U.S. that may or may not be enforced, you know, like riding your buggy down the main street at, you know, at midday. But they also include a lot of sexual practices that, you know, that most people these days would consider to be mainstream and yet are sort of technically illegal. The analogy I often draw, you know, and again, I rely on United Kingdom sources, but, you know, you could go to other countries too, is that the Wolfenden Committee of the Home Office in England was asked to produce a report in 1957 on prostitution and homosexuality, two vices, if you like, you know, that had both been criminalized at the same time in, under the Criminal Law Amendment Act of 1885. And because it was a committee mainly of men, and only male homosexuality was outlawed, they recommended decriminalizing homosexuality but increasing criminal sanctions against prostitution. Well, let's see what's happened in around the, you know, not only in England but around the world since 1957. Well, it actually took 10 years for it to be put into law and became decriminalized in 1967. Well, did the stigma of homosexuality disappear overnight when the law was passed? No. Did it disappear in 5 years' time? No. Did it disappear in 10 years' time? No. Did it disappear in 20 years' time? Well, yeah, it started to fade. Has it disappeared completely now? No. But can you appear on primetime television and say you're gay? Yes. You know. So, you know, several people have written articles saying that, you know, legal people saying that decriminalization is a necessary but not sufficient step to deconditioning the stigma in society against sex workers. And that's brought out by the recent study in New Zealand, that although it has been legal for 5 years, there is the stigma still remains. You know, it's going to take another generation for that to disappear completely, but it won't disappear so long as it's criminal. Because people think, you know, in their minds, being simple people, if the government says it's bad, it must be bad.
Yeah. Definitely. We've got about 2 minutes till the show is going to stop streaming live. Those listening will probably want to call in at 646-200-3136 to continue listening to Cult of Gracie on XXBN, Swap East Media Project out of Raleigh, North Carolina. Or if you have questions, again, call in 646-200-3136. This social stigma thing is something that interests me because when I define sex work, I'm covering everything from the person who designs the vibrator, mm-hmm. the phone sex operator, the you know, bodice ripper that actually, you know, looks at the bodice once it's ripped open, author, those, you know, I'm including lots of people here,
of course,
because
yes.
I believe that anyone that helps people further, you know, in that case, you would rather be a sex worker because you are helping people get closer to having, you know, less dysfunction in their sex lives.
Mm-hmm.
And while you're not the hand, you're helping. And I was shocked a few years ago when I've been trying to find the news story and haven't been able to find it yet. Again, a woman went in for her daughter, I believe it was, the you know, bring your parent to work day, career day thing. And the school was outraged and upset because the mother was a stripper. Now, that's a legal profession.
Hmm.
And yet, you know, there was this great big ruckus in all of that. And I was dumbstruck because I thought, it's legal. Now, you know, I don't know, remember, I couldn't find the article, so I can't remember exactly, again, how old the children were. But, you know, we teach our children to walk past bars and that they, you know, on their way home from school, that they can't go in and have a drink, that that's adults only and it's something they can't do. And if there are any clubs around or whatever, or advertised in a paper, children have to learn to navigate their way around that. And it is legal, but there was this, you know, huge uproar that how dare this mother come in and share her career. And it's one of these things to me where I say, you know, even when it's legal, it's still stigmatized that, you know, you can't walk in and say what you do. But I guess, you know.
I guess what's illegal there is actually the discrimination. I mean, one can think of other analogies, maybe some years ago, you know, whereby if somebody's father came in who was a chimney sweep or something, you know, there might be, they're equal to the horror, you know, or a sewage worker or something like that. That we do, you know, discriminate, you know, as a society against a whole lot of things that we sort of despise or, you know, consider to be inferior occupations. And that's what all this struggle about human rights and discrimination is mainly about. I'll give you a healthy analogy, and that is, I'm on the board of an outreach organization for local sex workers, and our executive director, you know, has a 2-year-old daughter, and basically, you know, she has a, she's probably a bit more than two by now. She has her packing condoms and has her taking her out on the strolls, you know. And she actually said this to a government committee that was investigating prostitution, that she was proud of the fact that she was bringing up her daughter to learn about prostitution from day one. You know, it should be taught in schools, you know. People should know about it, you know, instead of avoided, you know. This whole idea of adult that you mentioned before, I mean, there's so much hypocrisy, isn't it? I mean, you know, apart from the forbidden fruit phenomenon, that something's adult, you can't do it, and so, of course, naturally everyone does it, you know. So, you know, teach people about what goes on in bars and, you know, and about drinking responsibility. Don't tell them to avoid it, you know.
But you tell your young children, you know, when you're walking home from school, that's not the same thing as stopping in at the convenience store to get a soda. You're going to have to walk past the bar. That's not for you.
Yes, but you're far better off explaining to them why. I mean, and that goes, whole field of parenting, you know, saying
right.
don't
well,
do it because
saying,
I say
you,
so.
You
were talking about masturbation the other day.
You teach your kids that, but you won't talk to them about, you know, anything else they might pass up. And I don't know what the television's like in Canada, but I mean, just the things that are on at 7 o'clock at night. Here I'm awfully fond of picking on 2.5 men. But I can't watch that when my nieces come over because there's stuff on there that I don't know that mom has really discussed with them. And as an aunt, I'm not really sure, you know, I want to be the one having that conversation with children that are younger. But it's just, you know, it's all right into the dialogue. They don't show any TNA, but they're talking about it constantly.
They know far more than you think.
Well, and
I mean, my mother never... My mother never censored our television at all, but because she said, if you're old enough to understand it, then you probably know about it, and if you don't, it's probably over your head anyway.
But it was, you know, they were over and the show was on, and I didn't think about it until
they sat down with me,
and I went, okay, and I went, wow, you know, because I'm an adult and I see it and I know it's there, and I'm a big believer that if you don't want your children to watch it, then you handle the remote or you sit and watch with your kids and answer the questions. But here I was, you know, they weren't mine. They weren't mine.
When is your own children? When is your own children? You're there to answer their questions, and
right.
You'll get a lot further by doing that than sticking a forbidden sort of label on it.
Right. Well, what I did was just switch to a different show and said I usually watch something else just to, you know, change the thing. But I thought, you know, it was in my mind the rest of the night thinking, you know, this stuff is in everything. I mean, we leave Cosmopolitans laying around on our coffee tables, but we hide the Playboys. And Cosmo really isn't, you know what I mean? Cosmo really isn't, you know, the little high life reader that's waiting for you in the doctor's office. Mm-hmm. And I don't have a complaint against either publication. I just have a complaint against the distinction that some things are just left out there. They're around kids everywhere, but then a stripper can't say that she has a legal profession and talk to kids about it. But would they let a model in, or would they let somebody come in recruiting for teenage pageantry or, you know, 8-year-old pageantry?
When you look at what models wear these days, yes, you might.
Just
think of all of the things that we considered, some people considered to be obscene, you know, 150 years ago, in which, you know, nobody would think twice of, you know, now, you know. So, I mean, these things are not essential. They are, you know, contextual. They're not absolute.
Which brings me to a point, which I'm not sure you can answer this, so it might be kind of unfair, but a friend of mine and I were having a debate.
Yes.
About, you know, she's a big believer that right now in the United States, the conservatism, I literally, you know, pull up my collar all the time thinking that it's my shirt choking me, but it's really the administration and legislation and the morality here. Too thick to breathe. And she was saying, just wait, the pendulum will swing back, you know. And I said, I don't, if it is this, you know, looking at it from history, I see some swings, you know, I can see a little bit of that. But I don't know that I can, that I'll be alive when it swings back. And I really am, you know, irritated that I have to have my body and my soul legislated to me. But what are your thoughts on this pendulum business? Do you think that it's swinging back, or do you think it still has further to go, you know, to the conservative side?
Well, I mean, there's always a degree of pendulum, you know, in most cultures. But as I said, on this particular issue, at least within the United States, it's certainly very difficult to see. I mean, that, you know, you may get some minor changes in the short term, but I don't think you're going to get some major changes in the short term. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to be pessimistic. I would like to be optimistic about it, but one can speculate, of course. But in the end, society is us, you know. We have a collective responsibility, and sitting around and talking about what the government may or may not do, you know. I mean, you've got to get out there and do something, you know. Well, I mean, we are doing something.
Yeah, we're standing up and we're taking the hardest hammering because we're the ones standing up the tallest. I wish more people would stand up because I don't think very many people realize that what they have to lose by this. I mean, issues of legislating sexuality and morality is today's sex workers, tomorrow's homosexuals. You know,
every time a prominent politician falls on questions of sexual morality, you know, the response is always much the same, and it's always surprise and shock and horror. You know, Henrik Ibsen, you know, wrote this, you know, book called called The Pillar of the Community, you know, in the late 19th century, you know, which pointed out that the people who have the most to say about public morals are probably the people who are most vulnerable on it, and you know, and we continue to see this every day, whether it be President Bush's, you know, prostitution czar, or the late governor of the, you know, of New York State. I mean, you know, there are so many people out there in government. Or look at, you know, our dear friend Deborah Jean. You know, I mean, you know, and her little black books. You know, what was going on in government in D.C. You know, I mean, you know, how can people be passing legislation, you know, when, you know, they're the people who are basically out there promoting it?
I think that goes back to the prohibition analogy, where people feel that they themselves are weak and vulnerable to something that they don't like about themselves or they fear about themselves, and they realize they can't control themselves, so
yep.
They decide that they're going to have to, have someone else enforce and police them, and then they work that fear on other people who maybe are not afraid personally. But
always fear most that which people fear in themselves.
You get Spitzer gets a group of women worried that it's going to be their husbands next, and so then the women, you know, and then they pass the fear on down the line to the next group. And it's really, I think Gloria Bram had said something about to imagine being a sex worker is to have someone lecture you about morality and how horrible you are while you attend their genitalia. Because, you know, it's the very same people that are out there screaming and stamping their feet and shaking their fingers and thumping their Bible and going to Congress are, you know, the people using the services. So it's really, you know, kind of like bizarro land. And I think that that's what a lot of some of the more less vulnerable members of our work will really feel, that they're insulated well because they think it won't happen to them because, you know, they know the politicians in their town. You know what I mean? And just because something hasn't hit the fan yet there, they really think that, well, because I know these people, it wouldn't happen.
Yeah, there's always been a divide between private and public morality. And in fact, that's actually one of the problems about sex work, is that, you know, it tends to cross the line. You know, it tends to be sort of become visible. You know, when every, you know, important man sort of, you know, kept a mistress, you know, by the side, you know, then it was sort of, but it was all sort of hidden. It wasn't, you know, and if you brought her out in public, then it became a different issue altogether. You know, I was in, you know, Europe, you know, when the Clinton disposition, you know, deposition occurred, you know, and, you know,
yeah.
it was, every time I changed the channel from sort of Sweden to Norway to Germany to Finland, you know, exactly the same program was running, you know, which was, you know, Clinton saying, I did not have sex with that woman. And, you know, I'm looking at my sort of, my, you know, European friends, and they're all rolling around on the floor laughing, and they're sort of saying, what's anyone complaining about it? We all know every politician does that. Why are Americans, you know, thinking it's unusual, you know?
Well, I guess that's, you know, I don't know if it's because we're a baby young country or if it's just that still that good old-fashioned Puritan, you know, stock that just, you know, lies deep within too many of us, because we really seem to be more obsessed with this than a lot of other places.
Yeah, there's a lot of theories about that. There's an old joke about, you know, the Australian and the American, and they're discussing their common, you know, colonial heritage, and the Australian says to the American, "Oh, thank God we got the convicts."
Yeah.
You got the Puritans.
Yeah.
All right, but you know, I don't think it's as simple as that, though. You know, just to say, well, you know, we got a lot of, you know, got a whole lot of Puritans. Actually, you know, Australian history is actually more interesting than that, because in fact they not only got a whole lot of convicts, they also got a whole lot of prostitutes too. That was one way of getting rid of them, was to ship them off to Australia.
Yeah, which only made them wealthier.
Well, yes, that's right.
One of the things I want to mention is U.S. aid and the pledge that the United States regarding funding. I'm assuming you know some of that.
Oh, yes.
How that's playing out in Cambodia right now?
Well, I mean, it's playing out all over the developing world. I mean, I think that amongst experts in public health, I mean, most people feel that U.S. foreign policy on this has been a total disaster, you know, imposing sort of, you know, U.S. morality on the rest of the world. Well, sorry, not, you know, I shouldn't say that. I'm being very unfair there. U.S. administration morality on the rest of the world. In the prostitution pledge, I mean, it's absolutely appalling, you know, and certainly has done the opposite of what it's supposed to do. In other words, it's actually hindered, you know, the fight against AIDS. I mean, one of the more inspiring things at the last World AIDS Congress that was here in Canada, it was in Toronto actually, was the way that sex workers from around the world, particularly from developing countries like Africa, were in the vanguard. They were the ones who were leading, you know, the fight against AIDS. They, you know, and that's something we haven't really touched on. We've touched on all of the purported social evils of prostitution. We haven't touched on the social benefits of prostitution. And when the British government were trying to legislate against prostitution, it failed because there was so much opposition a few months ago. One of the demonstrations in the parliament was from the disabled.
Yeah.
And you've probably heard accounts how in, you know, in many countries in Europe now that, you know, the state will actually pay for you to, you know, get the services of a sex worker, you know, if you're disabled.
That would have been wonderful for some of my former clients. They would have been very happy with that.
Yeah. The other is just building on what we were talking about before about the role of sex workers in developing countries is the idea of the sex worker as a health and sex educator. And again, my friend and colleague Dr. Teela Sanders in Leeds, the University of Leeds in England, has studied that and written about that, and saying that basically, you know, we should be supporting and funding sex workers because they are actually, you know, they know far more about sexuality, about sexual health, and, you know, and about infectious diseases than the rest of the population. And they should be out, you know, we should be helping them and go out there and teaching the rest of the country to live up to the sort of standards that they live up to.
Well, I think it's astonishing that you know, not just the imposing of morality, but that, I don't know, sometimes I just really wish that, you know, I mean, in the United States, I feel very insulated from the rest of the world reaction because my government doesn't want me to know about it. But you know, I wonder, you know, that things like, sometimes I really think that, you know, someone needs to tell little tyrannic King Georgie here that, you know, the rest of the world does not like this.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know, he's almost done, but, you know, I hope he doesn't have much of a legacy with.
But he didn't get there single-handed, though. Somebody voted for him.
Right.
Oddly enough, nobody I know actually did vote for him. Every time I'm in the United States,
everyone
is very anxious
every
to
year.
Tell me that they didn't do so. But anyway, you know,
less and less admitted every year. The numbers dwindle every year.
It's amazing, isn't it? So, you know, maybe we should just be turning it around and promoting sex work, you know, as a social benefit. You know, you were talking about Bible thumping a little while ago. I mean, you know, if I find myself encountering, you know, the really more rabid Bible thumpers, I say, you know, have you read your Bible? Well, naturally, of course, yes, like every day. And I said, then who did Jesus choose as his friends? And who did he hang out with, you know?
Yeah.
Harlots and tax collectors. were the people he chose as his friends. And I said, and I'm proud to say that some of my closest friends are sex workers.
Yeah. Well, that's another issue that maybe we should save for when you come back, is the one of the fears
back.
With... Yeah, you're going to have to come back another time because it might be too big, but
yeah.
Some of the fears...
It is a big
story. You know, regarding taxes and legalization, and the if we decriminalize, you know, what are some of the better ways to do that? We might have to table that. But I did want to mention regarding health and safety and STIs. One of the things that's always struck me as very, not funny in the laughing, but funny in the strange category, is a story out of Las Vegas and how the professional brothels, the legal brothels. The sex workers are required to have health screenings in order to get in, and then I believe it's once a week.
Yes.
Or so.
But their clients aren't.
But their clients don't.
How's that for hypocrisy?
Yeah, no, and,
well,
and it really speaks to the value.
Yes.
You know, society is going to value the client, who is also breaking the law, is the way it stands right now. You know, I was just wondering if you've heard of any other models
Well,
work.
I know of jurisdictions where, you know, prostitution is legal to some extent but regulated, and where health checks are required. And I can tell you that the people who work in those sexual health clinics will tell you that they have never seen an STI in a sex worker, you know? It's a complete and utter waste of time, you know? You're basically looking at the healthiest section of the population and screening them for STIs. You should be providing them with better training, although they usually are quite well trained as to how to detect and diagnose STIs in their clients. And
right.
You know, in New Zealand and Australia, for instance, you know, where it is legal, then naturally, being a business, it falls under occupational health and safety regulations, and both of those countries have produced wonderful, you know, illustrated manuals, you know, basically of how to be a good sex worker, you know, and what you should do, and, you know, and basically how to examine your client carefully and how to diagnose STIs.
Yeah. I think we're going to have you come back and talk about that, because I'm running late tonight, and since we have no one else listening to us at the moment, since we're not streaming.
Oh, we've run over, have we?
Yeah, we went over about 17 minutes, according to the clock.
Oh,
yeah, when you're
having fun, yes.
Yeah, what I will do is email you and schedule another date, and we can talk
sure.
about that.
Yeah.
And I apologize to you for the issue here with the switchboard and the server hosting. But
it's totally out of your control, Gracie.
But it still is a pain in the butt. Anybody listened who went this far and didn't give up after dead air, we'll have to see if we can edit that for better download, so no one has to pay.
Oh, yes, we don't want to have something great gap in the recorded.
Still think it just ended, so we'll have to see if we can do that.
Yeah.
Well, I thank you very much for your time, and
no, not at
have
all.
You back on soon.
Enjoyed it very much,
and we only
just skimmed the surface, really. And
right.
Because
well,
it gets into... Well, it gets into so many other areas of human behavior, and that's why I think it's such an important subject. I mean, there was... I'll tell you this interesting story about New Zealand again, that the Ministry of Higher Education there basically had, you know, published a policy paper to say that, you know, that universities should be independent of what they teach, and, you know, the government would fund them but would not dictate, the subject matter, which seems reasonable, and some smart reporter, you know, said in a news conference, you know, at a press conference to the Minister of Education, said, oh, you know, because prostitution had been legalized in New Zealand, and said, so it would be okay then for a university to teach prostitution. And the minister, sort of without thinking, basically said, I just said we wouldn't interfere with what they would, you know, teach. But it was a setup, obviously, wasn't it?
Right.
So, of course, you can see the headlines the next day, you know, Minister advocates teaching prostitution in universities. And then this went all around the world, and particularly amongst all the prohibition, you know. But, in fact, there are many universities that do teach prostitution. I mean, they teach, you know, I am told by instructors now that it's becoming such a popular course that they basically, you know, they can't, you know, they just have to turn people away. People all want to learn about prostitution. Not necessarily in a vocational sense, but they want to study it because, you know, it's a fascinating subject, particularly amongst women.
Well, I think as a young feminist, I was writing about this the other day. I grew up in the 70s, and I was too young to be part of the movement when it had real big heat. But I grew up hearing the conversation, you know, anything from going to your friend's house and hearing their parents talk at the TV table to the news to, you know, just what was, you know, running on the television set and shows and magazines. And I remember Dworkin was a huge part of my foundation. Without Andrea Dworkin, I would not have had the conversation with myself to decide how I felt about things. And originally, yeah. I was very much along with her thinking when I was younger,
yeah.
until I started to find out why it didn't feel, you know, find it, you know, I really, without her, I wouldn't have examined those things for myself. So I sometimes jokingly say that without Andrea Dworkin, I wouldn't have ended up as a sex worker, which probably makes her roll over in her poor little grave. But I say that with the utmost respect, because without those conversations, I wouldn't have known what I was doing. And I think a lot of young women today really want to, you know, they hear one thing and such polarized things, and they want to, you know, they want to find their own way there.
Well, as I was sort of thinking about, you know, this discussion tonight, I was having those similar thoughts, and I was thinking that, you know, the great debate, you know, in feminisms about this is useful in the sense that, you know, that it raises a lot of issues that are important and need to be thought about and discussed, you know, whether one agrees with the conclusions or not, you know. But I said, in the end, I said, you know, any discussion that doesn't involve the actual actual sex workers and talks about them in the abstraction, you know, is doomed to not really advance our understanding very far.
Yeah,
and, you know,
amen.
fortunately, there are a lot of, you know, you're talking about how many academics are out there. There are largely a lot of academics who are sex workers and a lot of sex workers who are academics. a friend of mine who's actually in the law, I talk about England a lot because I said that is where a lot of the research is going on, who's at the law school in Kiel in England. She got onto the internet and she designed a survey for escort workers, and she persuaded, you know, an escort worker forum, you know, to allow her to post her stuff there, and she got about 250 responses, you know, and it included things like, you know, your education and, you know, other activities, you know, because not all escort workers are full-time. And she does her first run on the analysis, you know, and she calls me up and says, I think there's something wrong. And I said, what's the matter, Suzanne? And she said, an awful lot of these people, she says, you know, are judges, lawyers, nurses, police women, you know, and university professors. And I said, yeah, that's right. Didn't you know that? And I said, and your next door neighbor too. Just that they tend not to talk about it over dinner.
Yeah.
Maybe one day we will be able to talk about it over dinner.
Well, I think that's another interesting point we were talking about the other day. Amanda Brooks and myself on a different show, we talked about some of the things you talked before about the who is a sex worker and who isn't and the kind of infighting there.
Yeah.
But also this notion of that there are different segments, not just escort and street worker, but, you know, education differences. And, you know, like I said before, someone who's a courtesan or a companion or an escort is probably going to have far more internet access and be able to participate in that sort of a survey than a street worker is going to.
Absolutely.
So you have to
devise your approach accordingly.
And acknowledge what kind of, you know, pool of people that you're targeting here, you know, that this is going to speak for people who can, you know, nothing else. This is for people who can afford an internet access. You know,
yeah,
this is going to preclude another group of people simply for an economic starting point. But, you know, it's one of those things where when they just talk to people on the streets, you know, if you talk to a person on the streets who's working, you know, what's almost full-time but not full-time, so he doesn't get benefits at a fast food joint and can't afford to make ends meet and is homeless, you know, you could go on the streets and create a survey of that, too, because those people are there. But somehow we're less fascinated in what really causes poverty and despair. We're more interested with, you know, the sex work.
Well, the only way you're really going to get reliable answers from street sex workers is by basically getting other street sex workers to collaborate with you in terms of rounding up their friends and bringing them to talk to you, which means you're going to have to spend a lot of time earning their trust and their respect and their love, if you like. You know, I mean, obviously it's a lot easier if you work in an outreach organization like I do, where they're coming in and dropping into the home, you know, all the time, but they're actually a little bit fed up with their fill being researched to death, and I tend to rather agree with that, so I'm a bit protective of them from that point of view. But as I said, if they've got some ideas about research that should be done, I'm happy to hear it. I suppose we should say hello to Amanda, should we, in case she's out there listening?
Yeah, probably.
I think she's a mutual friend of ours.
We're waving, but she can't see us.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I'm gonna, like I said, I'm gonna have to let this go for tonight. But I thank you for coming on. I'm gonna get back to you with the date, and
yes,
I will post
yeah.
that so that everyone listening can.
We'll make it that, Gracie.
Well, and thanks so much for your time and for the work that you do.
Okay, and for yours. You're doing a good job too. Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks.
Good night.
Bye bye. Bye. This has been Cult of Gracie Radio on XXBN. Good night. I'm going to have